across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this podcast from the BBC. Today, more questions. This is familiar. More questions for Sinn Féin around safeguarding issues in the party, all developed on the programme this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. As you've tuned into the Nolan Show for the last couple of weeks now, you'll have heard questions about Sinn Féin at the top of the programme. And it's similar when you've been opening your newspapers and you've looked at the front pages. Sinn Féin has been embroiled in safeguarding controversy day after day after day. And yet again this morning, it is facing questions, this time over why it did not reveal the real reason why Niall O'Donnell, the former Lord Mayor of Belfast, once rising star in the party, suddenly quit frontline politics last year. Yesterday, Mr. O'Donnell released a statement to the Irish News confirming he was the former Sinn Féin member who sent inappropriate text messages to a 17-year-old boy who was a junior member of the party. The message is believed to have been personal in nature, but not sexually explicit. Sinn Féin said it notified the PSNI when it first became aware of the messages in September last year. The party's president, Mary Lou McDonald, said there were no findings of illegality, no criminal charges were pursued. She said O'Donnell's behaviour was unacceptable. She said following an internal inquiry in October 2023, He stated he would resign from the party and step down from his role as senator in the Republic, where he was Sinn Féin's leader in the Senate. But Mary Lou McDonald is facing questions over why the party did not make public the reason behind his resignation before now. Instead, when Mr. O'Donnell formally stepped down in December, citing health reasons, Mary Lou McDonald issued a statement giving a glowing tribute to Mr. O'Donnell. Yesterday, she set out the timeline around when the complaint first came to light, and she faced tough questions from other parties in the Dáil.
A further issue that's been the subject of public commentary relates to an incident where a Sinn Féin representative sent inappropriate text messages to a 17-year-old. That representative was Senator Niall O'Donnell. On the 11th of September 2023, a party councillor received a complaint that an inappropriate message had been sent by Niall O'Donnell to a 17-year-old male party member. The young man wanted this to stop and he wanted no further contact to be made to him by Niall O'Donnell. On the 12th of September, the chairperson of Belfast Sinn Féin was informed of the complaint and so began the formal party procedure. As part of the party's inquiry at the time, we were informed of a second individual receiving inappropriate text messages from Niall O'Donnell. This person was an adult. He was advised of his right to make a formal complaint, but he chose not to. On the 13th of September, in line with our child protection guidelines, given that the complainant was under the age of 18, Niall O'Donnell was suspended from the party and the issue was immediately referred to the PSNI and social services in the north to investigate. This was clearly not a matter for any political party to adjudicate on. The PSNI investigates crime, social services supervises safeguarding issues and processes. On the 27th of September, the PSNI informed the party that there was an agreed joint investigation between the PSNI and social services. No formal investigation followed. The PSNI also informed us that the young person was content with the actions taken by the party. There was no finding of illegality and no criminal charges were pursued. However, Niall O'Donnell's actions were not acceptable. This view was made clear to Niall O'Donnell at a meeting on October the 5th involving the party chair, the chief whip and the chairperson of Belfast Sinn Féin. At that meeting, Niall O'Donnell stated that he would be resigning both from the Seanad and the party. as Count Corliss Sinn Féin's actions were firstly guided by concern for the young person at the centre of this incident. Secondly, by the need for accountability and consequences for the actions of Niall O'Donnell. And he faced those consequences, ones that were proportionate to his unacceptable behaviour. The party had received legal advice against naming Mr O'Donnell, as there was no criminal charge brought against him. However, the question may be asked and has been asked legitimately as to why Sinn Féin didn't inform the Oireachtas of the circumstances of Niall O'Donnell's resignation as a senator. And that's a fair question, and let me answer it. In the summer of 2021, Niall O'Donnell was on extended leave from his duties in the Shannon due to very serious mental health issues. Following the complaint, we were advised that Niall O'Donnell was again suffering from a mental health crisis and was deemed medically unfit for work by his doctor. As Count Corliss, we were very worried that publicly naming him would be dangerous to his health. And that is not to make an excuse for his behaviour, but we had very serious concerns for his mental health and his safety. And I still hold some of those concerns to this very day. Niall O'Donnell publicly resigned on December 21st last. And on that occasion, I wished him and his family well. I acknowledged his work in the past. And above all, I wished him well in dealing with his very, very significant health challenges. Niall O'Donnell was held to account as a result of the procedures in our party, pursuing accountability and consequences. The matter was referred to the PSNI for criminal investigation and the social services as a direct result of the procedures of our party. This case has clearly impacted, especially on the young person receiving these unwanted and inappropriate messages. Despite the position that Niall O'Donnell held in our party, he's been held to account, and the safety of that young person has been the foremost concern.
Well, listening to this, the Northern Ireland editor of the Belfast Telegraph, Sunday Independent, Sam McBride. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
There's a few things here where I'm just absolutely, totally confused. So Mary Lou McDonald has said, we've just heard it there, that she still holds concerns to this day that she had back then when she didn't want to talk about Niall O'Donnell's situation because of his mental health concerns. If she still shares them to this day, how come she can talk about them now and not then?
Well, one element of that is that yesterday it was Niall O'Donnell himself who put out this statement. Now, I think it's very important for people to understand that he did that unwillingly. He didn't want to do that. The party was first approached by the Irish Independent, by my colleagues there, last Wednesday with questions about him. He wasn't named in those questions, but they knew exactly who we were talking about because it was clear that this was well known at the top of the party, and those were pointed questions about exactly what had gone on here. Over the following days, he was personally approached. He didn't want to comment. And I think by yesterday, there was such a sense of unease within Dublin about this, that it was likely he was going to be named in the Dáil under parliamentary privilege, and rather than have his rivals, if you like, rather than have Sinn Féin's rivals do that on their terms, he decided to come out and put himself out there as the person who had acted, as he says, inappropriately. So having done that, I think it's then easier for Mary Lou McDonald to follow that on. I'm obviously in no position to talk about his mental health. I've got no reason to doubt that he genuinely has difficulties in that area. However, or at least had at the point where he left the Shannon. However, I think what is clear from his statement is that he accepts that this was behaviour that was completely indefensible. He accepted that the penalty for that was complete expulsion, if you like, from public life. That's a very high penalty. And so therefore, his own behaviour, it would seem, contributed to what happened last year. And I think a lot of people will have limited sympathy for him on that regard, even if they have sympathy for his health issues.
What did he do?
Well, he has accepted that he sent inappropriate messages to a teenager, somebody who was a member of Sinn Féin, somebody who, as we understand, was canvassing with Sinn Féin. He approached them after that. It was said by Mary Lou McDonald last night in a TV interview that he had acted utterly inappropriately. There's very strong language coming even from Sinn Féin about this. As we understand it, those were not explicitly sexual messages, but they were physical messages, and the clear intent of them was inappropriate. And I think the fact that there's no attempt here by Niall O'Donoghue, who you will know, I certainly knew as a former Sinn Féin press officer, somebody who knows his way around the media, somebody who knows how to get his own side of the story across. The fact there's no attempt by him to suggest that this was anything other than completely wrong, completely a real abuse of power, if you like. There was a massive power imbalance between these two individuals, somebody who's the leader of Sinn Féin in the upper house of the Irish Parliament, and somebody who's a teenager, somebody who's who clearly should not be receiving messages of this nature. The fact that Niall O'Donoghue hasn't tried to make any argument in his own defence there, I think, says exactly how bad this really was.
And Sam, what I'm trying to do is step through to provide clarity for the public and us all this morning around this. What did happen, what didn't happen. So the fact that the police looked at this and felt that there was no need to take it further, is that because the young person was over the age of consent?
So it appears that this young person did not want the police to take things any further. He simply wanted this to stop. He didn't want this to go on. And once it was made clear that this wasn't going to go on, he appears to have been happy with that. So the police can, in many cases, only really have a serious prospect of looking into something with any sort of possibility of charges if they thought that was something that was proper, that was appropriate. And I have no idea whether that's what they thought in this case. It never even got to that stage here, it seems, because the police were being told by this individual he didn't want that, and therefore it didn't happen.
And this story, Sam, of course, among many other stories over recent weeks, where questions are being asked about Sinn Féin's safeguarding policies and how they try to keep things out of the public domain.
Well, I think one of several elements of this which are very damaging for Sinn Féin as a party is one element of it which is similar to Michael McMonagall. And I want to be absolutely clear, obviously what Niall O'Donoghue did is not at all comparable to what Michael McMonagall did. However, how the party handled this has really uncanny echoes, if you like, because with Michael McMonagall, they knew he was being investigated by the police for alleged paedophilia. They didn't know he was guilty. He was denying it at that point, but they knew it was at least possible that that was true and the police were looking into it. They got rid of him and they effectively, if you like, palmed him off to the British Heart Foundation. He ended up in a charity. He ended up working with kids, or I should say at least with one child that we knew of. And there is a situation there where Sinn Féin didn't want to be associated with this man. He was potentially toxic and they got rid of him and other people were put at risk. Here you have a situation where it's very different in terms of what Niall O'Donoghue did, but both he and the party knew and accepted and accept to this day it was completely inappropriate. It was going to damage Sinn Féin if it emerged publicly that such a senior figure in their organisation had acted in this way to another party member. And yet what did they do? They passed him off to the public, not privately with private references. They passed him off publicly as somebody who was a fine, upstanding member of society, somebody who had mental health difficulties. It was not expressed as mental health difficulties. They said just that he had clear advice from his doctor to step back from public life. There were messages of sympathy off the back of that from his rivals. There were people getting in touch to say that they were sorry to see him go. If those people had known the truth, if Sinn Féin voters had known the truth, if all of us had known the truth, people would have felt very, very differently about that. So you've got a situation here where he ends up as the honorary president of a GAA club in Belfast. We still don't know exactly what that role entailed, but what seems clear is that they knew nothing about the true reason as to why he'd left. I don't know what else he was doing, but there was a clear cover-up here of the truth, as Sinn Féin knew it. Now, what Mary Lou McDonald said in that clip that you played is that she didn't come out publicly here because they really feared for Niall O'Donoghue. They worried about his mental health. They didn't want to add to the burden. And I think there is some sense in which we can understand why somebody might feel that way in these very,
why did she give him a glowing reference? She didn't need to make a public statement, a glowing public statement, did she?
That's the issue. So you can understand why you might not come out publicly and say, here's why we're now getting rid of this individual who's been very prominent. But at the very least, Sinn Féin needed to keep an eye on what this person was doing, maybe quietly alert people in places like West Belfast, where that GAA club was, people who might have reason to keep an eye on him. And at the very least, even if they're not going to do that, and they say that's for the PSNI, that's nothing that they need to think about, even if you accept that, they did not need to come out and praise this person to high heaven. They did not need to come out and give this glowing statement of really admiration from the leader of Sinn Féin. Mary Lou McDonald didn't explain that yesterday, but that's, you know, I think it's clear what happened there. There was a deal done, basically. He would go quietly, they would praise him, and nobody would know the truth.
Well, she did address why Sinn Féin did not tell the Belfast GAA club. Let's have a listen.
Our job as a political party is to ensure that our processes are robust and that they are applied efficiently and without fear and favour. We have a responsibility to refer onwards to the appropriate statutory agencies and that thereafter then falls to the agencies in terms of sharing information, information like that.
So they're back to that again, Sam. They're back to saying once they pass it on to the police, that's it.
And it just feels like they wanted to wash their hands of this individual. We've had this over and over again in different organisations, but multiple times now in Sinn Féin, where people are either moved around internally or people are just put out, and basically the rest of society is left to fend for itself. Nobody is told the truth as to what Sinn Féin has, this special knowledge they have of what's happened. And I mean, if you're in a situation where you have the leader of Sinn Féin looking at that now, confronted with the reality of what we now know as to what happened here, and she says, you know what, I hold my hands up, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have done that, and if it happens again, it will not happen. That's not what we're getting here. What we're getting is Mary Lou McDonald basically saying if this happened again, she would do exactly the same thing. There's no repentance, there's no contrition, there's no acceptance that this was this clearly was problematic in terms of how it was handled. And what she also said yesterday was that this wasn't the only incident, and who knows where this ends up, but she said that they know of at least one other incident where Niall O'Donoghue was inappropriately contacting somebody who was an adult person. So, I mean, this is something that might have much more to it than even now is publicly known, but based on what we now know, it's clear that Sinn Féin has not acted in the way that you would expect a major organisation, which has been scrutinised around these issues, which says it has brought in outside people to advise it, which says it has done everything right and proper in terms of trying to have really clear procedures in place. Whatever those procedures are, they allowed the party to do what it did here.
I was driving home last night thinking about this whole story, and I was thinking about what Maria Cahill Sam has said. We're going to hear from Maria on the programme this morning. I was thinking about what she's been saying about this story over recent days, and it suddenly struck me that Michelle O'Neill in Stormont last week, when asked, said, "Of course I believe Maria Cahill," but that is inconsistent with the questions for Sinn Féin, which Maria Cahill still says is pertinent, in that they have never addressed how she was investigated, how she was confronted on Sinn Féin premises, she claims, as the victim of rape. Now, Maria, as you know, waived her anonymity. So the Maria Cahill story, no matter how long ago the incident happened, the horrendous rape of Maria Cahill happened, there are actually present day questions on behalf of Maria Cahill that maybe, Sam, the media should continue to pursue if Sinn Féin are now saying they will be open and transparent.
Stephen, if you look at what happened when that BBC Spotlight programme was first broadcast, when there was massive publicity around that, when Gerry Adams was under pressure, Mary Lou McDonald, lots of senior Sinn Féin figures were facing very difficult questions. I mean, it really would have seemed inconceivable to somebody like me, frankly, as sceptical as I am about some of these things, that you would have Sinn Féin back in this situation a decade on. I mean, even if it was purely out of self-preservation for the party, you would think Sinn Féin would have seen, here's how damaging this can be to us. Here is how much of a massive hit we can take if we don't clean up our act in this area. And yet here you have something that seems to be much more deeply rooted within the party. And look, as we've talked about before, this aspect of our society is unfortunately right across society. You've got paedophilia, you've got some very inappropriate behaviour, you've got all sorts of things that happen. Organisations have to deal with these things. That's the nature of life. But here you've got a situation that so long after that event, so long after there have been other questions about Liam Adams and about other people within the wider Republican movement, you've got a situation where the public are basically misled, clearly misled by the leader of Sinn Féin about somebody who was a senior figure, somebody who was put out in the media, somebody who was trusted to be the leader of Sinn Féin in the upper house of the Irish Parliament. And I mean, how did nobody within Sinn Féin look at that and say, you know what? We've actually done a lot of things right in this case. We've gone to the police. We've gone to social services. We've actually got rid of the guy. Why not just go the final little bit of the way and be honest about it? But it seems that was too much.
Well, Sinn Féin spokesperson on finance, Piers Docherty, has said it is a stretch to say Mary Lou McDonald gave O'Donnell a growing reference when he resigned from the party last year. Let's have a listen.
I think it's a stretch to suggest it was a glowing reference. She stated issues of fact that he served for a number of years.
Well, she didn't just state that. In the reference, she said Niall served diligently during that period and indeed prior to his time as a member of Belfast City Council. In particular, Niall made a valuable contribution to the Joint Oireachtas Committee on the implementation of the Good Friday Agreement. I hope Niall can overcome the health challenges that he's had to deal with over the past number of months, and I wish him and his family the very best for the future. Look, anybody hearing that from Mary Lou McDonald would be thinking that, look, wonder has Niall O'Donnell got a heart problem or, you know, some type of problem with his body?
Look, Stephen, lots of people listening to this will come from all sorts of various political backgrounds, but I think anybody listening to what Piers Docherty says there can recognise spin when they hear it. You don't need to be a journalist. You don't need to be a PR professional. It's obvious that the public were misled about what really happened here. I mean, this was a warm statement about a party colleague she respected, she admired, about somebody who she praised his service. There wasn't a hint of any sort of discomfort here. And, you know, at least be honest about that now. Don't try to fool the people by pretending, pardon me, that this somehow was anything other than it was. This was a public endorsement of his time as a public representative. She knew he was leaving in disgrace, but she told the public something very, very different.
Look, is Sinn Féin's press operation, its communication with the public, is it in disarray at the moment, or could no press operation handle these type of story after story after story, Sam? And that obviously in the context that they have lost Sean McGeer, who was their head of communications here in Northern Ireland. Sean McGeer had to go because he gave a reference to McMonagall when he knew that he was a child abuse suspect. He was claiming his innocence, McMonagall was, but McGeer still gave a reference for him. Is the party missing McGeer? Is this part of what's happening? They have no one at the head of the press operation with all that experience McGeer had.
Well, I think, Stephen, after what Sean McGeer did in terms of giving Michael McMonagall a reference to the British Heart Foundation, some people within Sinn Féin probably will be snorting at the idea that in any way they could be missing him right now. He was clearly somebody who had lots of experience in handling the media. He could be very aggressive. He could be very robust
McGeir
in trying
was
a, to...
Just for context when I declare this, McGeir was at the heart of Sinn Féin's decision to boycott the Nolan Show after we asked too many difficult questions, essentially. So just to self-declare that.
Well, yeah, and look, there were lots of us that he didn't like very much. If you asked certain awkward questions, you weren't flavour of the month with them. But, I mean, look, that's not really the issue here. I think that if you were to blame the Sinn Féin press office in any way for this, it would be really missing how extraordinarily damaging this was always going to be. You could have Alistair Campbell, you could have whoever you choose as the best press officer who could possibly try to get you out of the most difficult hole that you're in. This was a problem that was insurmountable. How do you spin? I mean, how does Piers Doherty try to spin that his leader has really been speaking warmly about somebody who we now know has behaved, as she says, indefensibly? I mean, there really is no way to try to get around that. I think where there is criticism here of Sinn Féin is that the only strategy really that I think a seasoned PR professional would give in that sort of circumstance is, look, hold your hands up, hold them up really high, throw yourself on the mercy of the public, say we've really screwed up here, we're going to make amends, it's not going to happen again. There will be people who will not accept that, who will say this has happened too many times, but there will be people, and really what Sinn Féin are worried about here is people who are going to vote Sinn Féin or might vote Sinn Féin in the Irish general election in just a few weeks potentially. Those are the people they need to target. Those are people who will give the party a fair wind here if they think they're being straight with them. How do you look at what was said yesterday? How do you look at what Piers Doherty is saying there about that statement and say that Sinn Féin are levelling with their own voters, let alone anybody else?
And there are also questions, and it's getting lost in this story as the story progresses, Sam. There are questions for the current leadership of Sinn Féin and their behaviour. So this is not just questions for people who we know either by admission themselves or a court, McMonagall in other words, has found that they have done wrongdoing. There are questions still for what type of leader, what type of minister is Conor Murphy if he hits out at the British Heart Foundation and attempts to make it their fault, the McMonagall saga, that they didn't do enough due diligence. There are questions as to why Conor Murphy corrupted the straight message to the public of how you can, a former employer can tell a future employer. And he put out a wrong message and then days later said, oh yeah, well, the Chief Constable seems to have put me right in that. Aunt Michelle O'Neill repeated it.
Yes, Stephen. And look, I think what the public are getting to see here is something that we've known for a very long time, but lots of this happens behind the scenes. It's done in phone calls, it's done in messages, it's done face-to-face. It's often not done with a paper trail. Now the public are seeing it, that when Sinn Féin are asked, and Sinn Féin are not the only party like this, but they are particularly aggressive when it comes to these issues. When they're asked legitimate questions, the default is often to go on the attack against the person asking the questions.
Tell me about it.
Doesn't matter how legitimate those questions are. You know very well. And I think that what you're seeing here, so if you go back to last week, last Wednesday, Niall O'Donnelly tweeted, and he was very active on social media. I mean, he was never off it. He had, I think, 160,000 tweets from his account, which then vanished yesterday, just around the time when he was making clear what he'd done. But last Wednesday, he tweeted, "Do you know, I'm starting to think maybe the Bell Tell don't like that a Republican is First Minister, dot, dot, dot." Now, that was in relation to the questions we were asking, along with lots of other media organisations, really every other media organisation, about what Sinn Féin had done around Michael McMonagall, how they'd handled that, what was really going on, were we being told the whole story? And it's now clear that really we were not, and it was only through questions that we got some more of the truth there. What people didn't know when they saw that message was that morning, Finan Sheehan, my colleague at the Irish Independent, had gone to Sinn Féin's press office in Dublin and he had asked very pointed questions about Niall O'Donnelly. So what you see there is somebody who really has the net closing in on him, and he goes on the attack. against the Belfast Telegraph. Now, it could have been anybody, but that very often is, I think, how Sinn Féin operate. And so what you're seeing here is Sinn Féin reverting to what is their default setting, if you like. They're in a crisis, and rather than accept, you know what, we've actually got something badly wrong, let's admit that. Despite all of the reasons that they might do that, even quite cynical reasons sometimes, they can't, because the default here is so hardwired that that's what they revert to. And particularly, we've got the press office obviously under strain. They've lost two people, but they've still got lots of other press officers. They thought about this very carefully. They had all week, really, from last Wednesday, all weekend, to think carefully, how would they get this out there? How would they frame it in the best possible way? And what we got yesterday was the best possible version of that from their view.
Sam, before you go this morning, and it is often the case that stories that are very, very important to be talked about, they get lost if there is another story which is grabbing the public attention. And one of the stories that you've been reporting on in recent days, that in any other times would be right up there in terms of the public consciousness, is that despite RHI, Stormont has still not implemented many of the recommendations, and it looks like they're never going to.
Yes, Stephen. I mean, look, what we've been talking about has been very depressing, and this, in a completely different regard, is thoroughly depressing. People will recall the RHI inquiry, Sir Patrick Coughlan, Diarmuid O'Brien, asking questions of witnesses, the people from the RHI inquiry's lawyers asking questions of Arlene Foster, Jonathan Bell, Martin Muir. I mean, all of the people who came before that that public inquiry. It cost millions of pounds. It was a lengthy process. It poured over how we are governed in Northern Ireland. It was a very uncomfortable process for the civil service and for politicians. And yet here we are, more than 4 years after that, and after really strong promises from the civil service, from our executive, that they would implement every one of Sir Patrick's recommendations, we're now told by the audit office, who have gone in and inspected whether they're really doing what they said they would do, that they've only implemented 26 out of 42 recommendations. Now, that's bad enough. That's, you know, something like 40% have been recommended after more than four, or have been implemented after more than 4 years. And it's much worse than that, because what the audit office said is that looking at the rest of the of those recommendations, five of them, they say, they think will basically never be implemented.
And what are they?
No matter how much time you're given.
What's Stormont not going to implement that was recommended?
So some of it is excruciatingly basic. So one of those recommendations was that, quote, any minister presenting the Assembly with legislation for approval should sufficiently read and familiarise themselves with that legislation and ensure an adequate evidence base is publicly available to demonstrate that the benefits justify any attendant costs.
And Stormont's refusing to implement that?
Yeah, so Arlene Foster, as you will recall, stood up and asked MLAs to vote into law the RHI regulations, which set up the scheme about cost controls. She later admits she never even bothered to read the legislation. What Sir Patrick is saying, unsurprisingly, what any reasonable person looking at that would say is, look, you know what, that wasn't a great idea. Maybe ministers should read legislation before they suggest it becomes law. What the audit office is saying is that hasn't been implemented, and they don't think it ever will be implemented.
What?
Based on what Stormont is now saying.
Well, what's the excuse for not reading legislation you're asking the rest of us to abide by?
I mean, I can't begin to get into the minds of people who think that that's unnecessary, but the audit office have looked at this independently, and that's not the only one of these five recommendations that are really quite basic. The second one says that people who are looking at big projects coming through Stormont departments, who sit on what are called departmental project boards, people who are basically saying yes or no to a big project, that they should be people who are independent of that project so that they can actually challenge some of the assumptions behind it. So if I'm bringing forward a project or I'm linked to a project, I shouldn't be involved in approving that. I mean, again, fairly basic stuff you would think in any organisation. That's something the audit office say they don't think is going to happen. Another really basic thing that...
Hold on, because I don't know this stuff. You do, I don't. So are you talking about people who have a self-interest in a project get the ticket off?
Well, not a self-interest as in they're going to benefit financially, but a self-interest as in they have been working on this project. It's their idea, or they're in charge of it. It's probably good for their career if it goes through. There are probably all sorts of reasons why they might want it to go through. And what happened with RHI was that this was just nodded through all sorts of stormont processes that were meant to safeguard public funds. And people were just, you know, basically saying, well, you know what? All these other people have said it's okay. And essentially, and I'm very much paraphrasing here in terms of a very long story, but they were basically taking the view, as Diarmuid O'Brien said at one point, that they had hoovered up all these assurances from other people. Well, if all those people think it's fine, it must be fine. Yeah, it'll be okay. What the inquiry is trying to get to here is to have a more rigorous internal process. That's too much for Stormont, it seems.
And when you say Stormont, who is turning this down?
Well, ultimately, ministers are accountable for what happens. So, I mean, the buck stops with Stormont ministers, with the executive. What we also learned from the audit office is that the current Stormont executive, which is back now, you know, many months, it has not even bothered at this stage to reconfigure, to set up again what they call a subcommittee, a group of ministers, a smaller group of the executive, which is focused on implementing the RHI inquiry recommendations. So, prior to Stormont falling, they had a group whose sole job was to make sure this stuff happened. Now they're not even pretending they have a group that's doing that anymore. I mean, it's not even on the agenda of the executive in terms of having that group there. So, I mean, you really get a sense from this that this has gone, it's over. There's been a lot of warm words from our ministers, from the head of the civil service, Jane Brady, who was brought in to basically implement a lot of this stuff. These people have made big promises. What the audit office is saying is they've looked at those, it's not happening. And the really interesting element of this, Stephen, is that this was foreseen by Sir Patrick Coughlin. Sir Patrick Coughlin was a pretty wily figure. He'd been around a lot as a High Court judge. He didn't trust Stormont to do the right thing, frankly. He put into his report that he wanted the audit office to carry out these periodic reviews of whether they were actually doing what they promised to do. Lo and behold, it turns out he was right. He needed to do that. So that at least is one part of the report that has been implemented thoroughly. So that's good. We're getting to see this. But are they actually going to change? There's not a hint. I went to Jane Brady, who's the head of the civil service, the other day. I asked questions. Rather than even answer those questions, they were passed down the line to a different Stormont department. I think that rather sums up the sort of culture that you have there. It's not something that's being taken seriously, and it's not happening.
Sam McBride, thank you very much. Sam's obviously with the Belfast Telegraph, 20 to 10. Paul's in Andersonstown. Morning, Paul.
Morning, Stephen.
So two different stories this morning. The refusal, the failure of Stormont to implement some of the recommendations after RHI, and the continuing story about Sinn Féin, Paul.
Okay, well, look, Stephen, I'm obviously on to speak about Sinn Féin. I don't know anything. I mean, I haven't up to speed about the RHI details. I'm just on to talk about the manufactured hysteria that we're seeing yet again. That we're seeing yet again on your show and other media outlets also. There's obviously an election coming up, probably next month, and what we're seeing now is the media class in the Free State and up here going full Jeremy Corbyn on Mary Lou McDonald, essentially trying to bring this person down. That's what the government media are doing on behalf of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael.
So you think all different media outlets, you know, I can't think of a media outlet in Northern Ireland which isn't reporting this story. Are you telling me you think they're all in bed with Fianna Fáil?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Because they're not. So what are you saying?
This is manufactured outrage.
So all of the media is manufacturing it. Everybody.
Stephen, what I'm talking about, I'm talking primarily the Dublin media class. I'm talking about the Free State media class are going after Mary Lou McDonald. They're going through Jeremy Corbyn on Mary Lou McDonald.
Well, it's a good opportunity, actually. It's a good prompt to bring in Hugh O'Connell, who's the political editor of the Sunday Times in Ireland. You must be part of that media class, Hugh.
Yeah, good morning from Dublin, Stephen. Look, this is some criticism, that the same sort of criticism that's been levelled at me and some of my colleagues here on social media since these stories began emerging. But I suppose it's important to point out that, you know, the Dublin media, in inverted commas, didn't force Brian Stanley to resign. didn't force Patricia Ryan to resign, weren't behind references written by two-party press officers for an admitted paedophile, and weren't behind inappropriate messages sent by a senator to a 17-year-old.
And I know, Hugh, you know this, but he did not admit to being a paedophile at the time the references were
That's
given.
Correct, yeah. Yeah, but has since admitted to, I think, 14 charges of 14 separate child sex offences. So look, I mean, this is a controversy not of the media's manufacturing or the media's making or the manufacturing of Sinn Féin's political opponents, but is a controversy primarily driven by Sinn Féin's mishandling of all of these matters. And, you know, it's a story, I think, that will run and run. You can see this morning that in the language that Sinn Féin representatives are using around Mary Lou McDonald not accepting any messing in her party, that they're circling the wagons around her leader. Around their leader, I should say. And, you know, I suppose that the comparison there has been made by your caller to what happened to Jeremy Corbyn. I mean, a lot of Jeremy Corbyn's difficulties were of his own making, and the way in which he ran the Labour Party. And I think that a lot of what's happening now is a consequence of the way in which Mary Lou has chosen to run her party. Sinn Féin representatives say that she's doing it in a way that is ensuring that these issues come to the fore and come to light. But some of these issues would not have come to light without media reporting, without Brian Stanley resigning, for example, without Patricia Ryan resigning, for example, without the Michael McMonagall affair happening in open court. We would not have known, for example, that a Sinn Féin senator resigned last December. We were told at the time this was for mental health reasons. This was because he was ill. He'd been signed off work for some considerable time. When in fact it was related to the fact he'd been suspended from the party for sending inappropriate messages to a teenager.
So, Hugh, where does this go, this story go today? And this must be a question that Sinn Féin is asking themselves and their electorate. Where does it go today? Where does it go this week? Is it over?
I think Sinn Féin definitely hopes it's over. I think Mary Lou McDonald, in her statement in the Dáil yesterday, in giving her statement in the Dáil yesterday and answering questions last night on RTÉ, will hope that she's put the matter to bed. Certainly, you can see that Sinn Féin are circling the wagons around their leader. You know, they're sending out party spokespersons, including Piers Doherty this morning, to defend her, defend Sinn Féin's handling of this affair. Various other senior party spokespersons sent out across broadcast media in the last 24 to 48 hours to defend the party's handling of this. I suppose there's two issues, really. In relation to Brian Stanley, he's disputed much of what Mary Lou McDonald has said yesterday, accused her of breaching Dáil privilege. Does he potentially come into the Dáil and give his own statement of what happened, account for what happened from his perspective? That could give the story new life. And similarly, in relation to Senator O'Donnell, Senator Niall O'Donnell, Sinn Féin kept this information from the Oireachtas for several months. They've been accused of misleading the Oireachtas, and that is a tricky position for the party to be in. And I think you can see even other opposition parties saying they need to, they need to explain more fulsomely why they gave such a glowing statement for Niall O'Donnell when he resigned in December of last year and did not disclose the fact that he'd been suspended from the party for 3 months prior to that.
And look, ahead of me asking this next question, to make it explicitly clear, McMonagall is guilty, criminally guilty, of child sex offences. There is no suggestion of any criminal guilt whatsoever with regards to Niall O'Donnell. It is fundamentally different.
Yes.
And O'Donnell has admitted to sending an inappropriate text to a 17-year-old, and there was no criminal offence caused whatsoever. But with that context made explicitly clear, here you had Michelle O'Neill and Mary Lou McDonald criticising those two Sinn Féin press officers for issuing references. In other words, public statements to McMonagall's future employer. Why is Mary Lou McDonald not capable, culpable of issuing a glowing reference for Niall O'Donnell when she knew there were question marks over his behaviour?
Well, her position is that that Niall was going through a very acute mental health crisis, and she was very concerned for his mental health. So I think Sinn Féin not disclosing this information, that he had been suspended from the party, and the reason why he'd been suspended, and indeed the fact that the PSNI and social services in Northern Ireland had looked at this issue and had decided not to pursue it any further.
But she went further, didn't she? She talked about how Niall had served diligently during that period.
Yeah. No, she did. I mean, look, there's no doubt. I heard Piers Doherty this morning dispute, I think, the idea that this was a glowing statement, a glowing endorsement of Niall O'Donnell. But it can't but be seen in that light when you read the words that she said in relation to him in this press statement issued a short time after a statement was issued announcing his resignation on December 21st last. So, you know, as I said, Mary Lou McDonald's position is that, you know, she didn't want to do anything effectively to compound an already very serious mental health crisis that Niall O'Donnell was going through. And so that's, I guess, the logic and the rationale. You can dispute that, you can call it into question, but that is her position, her logic, her rationale for doing what she did. But as I said, I think the more sort of major political problem for Sinn Féin is that they withheld information, pertinent information, from the parliamentary authorities down here, okay, and indeed from their parliamentary colleagues down here. And that is a problem, I think, that they're going to have to face up to in the coming days.
Hugh, thank you very much indeed. Nice to talk to you again. Now, O'Donnell has issued a statement to the Irish News, I believe, in that he accepted his behaviour, warranted stepping down from his Shannon role and as a party member. This would also give me space, he said, to improve my health and well-being. Issues I've been dealing with my doctor on since mid-2021. He said, I also accept that I have caused great embarrassment to myself, my family, friends and former colleagues. This was never my intention. Since resigning from political and public life almost a year ago and now as a private citizen, my main focus has been on improving my mental health and supporting a relative through a challenging period of ill health. We've been speaking this morning to Maria Cahill, the former Labour senator, who was in the public gallery in the Doyle yesterday. She told me Mary Lou McDonald should now consider resigning. I began by asking her if she accepted what she and Finn said when they stated they were protecting the mental health of Niall O'Donnell.
No, I don't accept that. I mean, regardless of his mental health, they had a duty to the Irish public, the people who effectively employ Niall O'Donnell, they elect him. And so they had a duty not to conceal that information from the Oireachtas. They could have gone quietly to the Oireachtas and said, this is the reason why he's stepping down, but we have a concern, and so here's how we're going to deal with it. They didn't even do that. And so, no, I think that was an excuse for the party to hide behind yesterday, and I don't accept it at all.
So what do you think needs to happen now?
I think that, first of all, one hefty apology is owed to the young person at the centre of this who received inappropriate texts, and the other person who reported that they had also received an inappropriate text. I think that has to come from the Sinn Féin Party President, Mary Lou McDonald, because of the nature of the statement yesterday. I mean, let's remember, this is only in the public domain because the Irish Independent put this on their front page last week, albeit they did not name Mr O'Donnell. The Sinn Féin Party would have still considered this information from the public had that not happened, and that's a very serious matter.
We talk about inappropriate texts in this story. Do we know what they are?
I've known about this case for quite some time, Stephen, and it's not something that I would want to put into the public domain at the minute, but I think that the Sinn Féin Party have a responsibility here, and therefore they should be telling the public what the nature of those messages were.
And this, obviously, this story, this particular story we're talking about this morning, comes right in the middle of other stories about Sinn Féin. There is no suggestion that Mr O'Donnell had done anything illegal, but McMonagall did. So what does Sinn Féin do, Maria, beyond the overhaul that Mary Lou McDonald has suggested?
I think the first thing that they need to do, and let me just be very clear, there is no suggestion of criminality on the part of Mr O'Donnell, but there is absolutely a suggestion of an abusive position, and I think that's serious. The party also, let me just highlight this, is also aware that there are potential ramifications for anyone arrested on an offence and the impact on their mental health also. But yet the First Minister stood up in Stormont and called that particular man a monster. So where was the concern for his mental health, irrespective of what he has been charged with? I don't think that was appropriate. And people might find that strange coming from someone like me who is a victim of abuse. But I actually think if you're going to treat your party members, you should treat them all equally. Albeit that Niall O'Donoghue, this is a totally different, unrelated matter, doesn't relate to any suggestion of criminality whatsoever. But, just on that mental health point, the party has a responsibility to all its members who are found to have engaged in inappropriate activity. So what they need to do is they need to actually stop being in a situation where the media are dragging information from them. Because in a situation where a political party holds back on information or conceals it until the media eventually report on it, that's not healthy for anybody. It's not healthy for democracy. It's not healthy for voters who put their trust in a political party. And it's certainly not healthy for the young person at the centre of all of this, who is watching it play out online, who is listening to inaccurate details in the public domain, and who watched, I am sure, that in the Dáil yesterday. That's actually really a really, really bad situation. It's completely inappropriate, and the party president should apologise to them.
You waived your right to anonymity to accuse a member of the IRA of raping you. Have you got questions that Sinn Féin have still not answered about your case?
Well, yeah. I mean, 10 years ago, I sat in the public gallery where the Sinn Féin party were being questioned around how the Republican movement dealt with matters of abuse and child protection. I sat back in the public gallery yesterday where my own case was raised again. Let me tell you very clearly, and I say it over and over and over, and the only reason that I have to say it over and over and over is because those questions have not been addressed. The Sinn Féin party effectively allowed me to be called a liar in the public domain. As recently, actually, as this week, I'm still getting tweets from Republicans and supporters of Sinn Féin calling me a liar and a fantasist. I think I've been vindicated on everything that I've said by independent reports, an apology from the Chief Constable, an apology from the head of the PPS. So here's what Sinn Féin have still yet to admit. One, that there was an IRA investigation in the first place. Two, that I was brought into a room to face my rapist. And three, that Sinn Féin officers were used by the IRA to question me about my abuse. And I did not ask for that IRA investigation. So that's actually, for me, it's sickening, and it is sickening. It has an impact on my physical health, and it has an impact on my mental health, which, by the way, Sinn Féin had absolutely no concern whatsoever, either for me as a victim or for the people who are involved at the centre of this recent case, unrelated case, not in relation to criminality, but in relation to inappropriate texts. Where was their concern for the people who received those texts at any point over the last number of weeks?
I want to bring this back to you yet again, because it struck me yesterday, actually. You've been in the media commentating about all of these recent events involving Sinn Féin, and they're continually saying they want to be open and transparent, despite turning the media in Northern Ireland down many, many times for interviews, I must add. But there are questions still to answer about you and your case. And Michelle O'Neill sat in Stormont just a matter, it was last week, and said she believed you. So how can she say she believes you, and yet some of the points that you're putting to Sinn Féin, they still haven't accepted?
This is a bit of a ridiculous situation, isn't it? I mean, I'm laughing, but it's really not funny. It's so appalling that any victim of abuse from any institution, whether it is a political party or an illegal armed organisation or a member of that organisation, is forced out effectively into the public domain. And can I also tell you why it is appalling? Because I receive communications from victims all the time from a wide range of places in society, and I am left then effectively to try to deal with those people, to try to get them support. So the longer that I am kicked around in the public domain and those questions are not answered by the Sinn Féin party effectively, that they don't just hold their hands up and say, you know what happened to Maria Cahill was despicable and we're really, really sorry that this happened to her. That then effectively has a knock-on effect on every other victim of abuse that comes forward, because they're angered by what they see. That was the reason that Paddy McGahan came forward to talk about his abuse by a man who was later convicted of that abuse, because he watched the way in which I was being treated in the Dáil during that debate 10 years ago. So, yeah, it is a ridiculous situation. It is absolutely unhealthy for democracy that party would continue not to admit that information, particularly when its own political party offices were used to question an abuse victim, a vulnerable abuse victim, about their abuse. It's an unhealthy situation for me, Stephen. Let me tell you, it has an impact, and I've said it twice now, on not only my mental health, but also on my physical health.
So are you calling...
But I also have a 14-year-old child who listens to interviews, or because you can't shield her from everything, so people will hear me on the radio, they hear me on the TV. Of course, they say to her, she's 14 years of age, I was pregnant with her when I made my police complaint. That's not really acceptable, that she's listening to people attacking her mother or calling her mother a liar either. And so there we go. There's another generation touched by Sinn Féin's efforts to conceal information from the public, and that is not acceptable in any way whatsoever.
As part of this review of Sinn Féin policy, are you calling on Mary Lou McDonald and Michelle O'Neill to review what that party is saying about what happened to you?
I think it's actually much more serious. I think in relation to Mary Lou McDonald, and I have been measured around this, I think, over the last number of years. I've never called for a resignation, I don't think. I think if Mary Lou McDonald was held to the same standard as any other party leader, she would have gone by now, with good grace and on her own terms. That hasn't happened, so I've given up on asking Sinn Féin to admit anything at this point. I actually think the matter should be just referred to a senior counsel, and that an inquiry should take place south of the border into their actions on a wide range of issues in relation to unacceptable behaviour when it comes to victims.
Maria Cahill, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, it's the Nolan Show from the BBC. Nolan Live on BBC Television tonight at 10:40 on BBC One, and then the iPlayer after that. So we've a full gamut of Nolan Shows today. Next, a private members bill that could give terminally ill people in England and Wales the right to end their lives is being introduced in the House of Commons today. Those who support a change in the law say it would give people nearing the end of their lives the right to a peaceful and dignified death. But critics say assisted dying could put pressure on vulnerable people and end up being seen as a cheaper option than caring for the terminally ill. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has called the idea of assisted dying dangerous and suggested it would lead to a slippery slope.
This is real life that I've done. I've sat with people at the bedside and people have said, I want mum, I want my daughter, I want my brother to go, because this is so horrible. I haven't said, that's the wrong thing to do. What I'm saying is something completely different, that introducing this legislation opens the way to people who aren't in that situation asking for this or feeling pressured to ask for it.
Well, the Reverend Rosie Harper is a Church of England priest, member of the campaign group Dignity in Dying. Reverend Harper, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. And the former Health Minister, DUP MLA, Jim Wells. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. Well, Rosie, the Archbishop of Canterbury and many others say you cannot ultimately guarantee that a lot of people will not be pressurised into taking their own lives.
I can understand why he feels that could be a risk. And the point is that this law that's being proposed would actually mitigate against that. At the moment, we don't have any way of ensuring that that doesn't happen, except after the person has died. So, for example, someone will go to Switzerland, have an assisted death, and then it's investigated to see whether they've been pressure put on. The law that we're proposing actually makes it so much safer, because we have to have two doctors verify that this person is terminally ill, and then a judge has to say, yes, this is right. And it makes it more transparent and more honest. And I think it's safer, not less safe.
Does it devalue life if you can switch it on and switch it off?
Oh, it's not switching it on and switching it off at all. It's people who are dying anyway. And were we not to have assisted dying, these people would still die just a couple of days or a couple of weeks later.
Well, that's not necessarily the case. It could be a couple of years later, couldn't it?
Yeah, but you see, you don't...
Because you can't predict when people will die.
No, but you can opt for it at whatever point you find your circumstances become intolerable. In Oregon, you sign up, and then several people have thought they were within six months, and have discovered that their lives actually continue fine. Once you've signed up, you don't have to do it. It's just that it changes the whole trajectory of the way in which you die. If you can know for sure that were it to become unbearable, there would be a way of dying more beautifully.
And what is that way? You describe more beautifully. How is death beautiful in any way?
Well, my personal experience is of my uncle who died in Switzerland, and he was suffering from a terminal brain tumour, and the doctors were telling him, and this is indeed what came about, that he would start fitting, that he would go blind, that he would no longer be able to have any control over his bodily functions. And he opted to have assisted dying set up for the point at which he reached that point and his family would see these terrible end stages. And in fact, what happened was he said, yes, this is the day. He was in bed. He was still with it enough to be able to have a nice glass of wine and some beautiful music. They told each other how much they loved each other. He took the medicine and for what it felt like to everyone was he just fell asleep. And those agonizing last few hours, days, weeks, they don't know how long it would have been, were spared. And my aunt, his wife, said to me afterwards, she was so profoundly thankful that she lived in a civilized country like Switzerland where that had been possible.
It must have been terrifying for that man to bring that glass to his own lips to kill himself.
No, I don't think it was at all. I think he was making an active choice about the manner of his death. He was shortening his death,
but
our
whole instinct is to be alive, isn't it? The physical motion of looking at that liquid, taking it to your mouth, swallowing it—that's not a beautiful. That is not a beautiful moment, Rosie, is it?
Very dramatic way of doing it.
But it's not. But it's not dramatic. It's literally our whole human instinct is based on staying alive. So to describe on that man's behalf that it was beautiful, what he did, do you think he felt it was beautiful?
Yes, I think he did. They talked about it a lot. That's the thing, that once it's possible, you can have proper, open, honest discussions with yourself, your family, your relations. And he was going to die anyway. It's not as if he didn't take it, he wouldn't die, but he would have died horribly. And this way, he died peacefully. Well, that's the compassionate thing.
Well, Jim Wells, in 03030805555, if you want to talk about this to us today, with us today. Jim Wells, at the end of the day, I'm pushing the Reverend Harper, but at the end of the day, it was this man's choice, and he got to die by his own hand, how he wanted to, rather than suffering pain.
Stephen, this is a very difficult issue. And first of all, make it clear that this legislation, if approved in Westminster, only applies to England and Wales. The Northern Ireland Assembly is going to have to make its own decision.
Correct.
On this issue. Now, once you break the cardinal rule that medical professionals are there to protect, enhance and save life, once you change that to a role of ending life, then so many issues extend from that.
But is that realistic, Jim? So yeah, that might be what's written down on paper, but we know everybody that has any experience of hospitals or someone dying knows that often doctors will introduce more morphine at the end of death, which alleviates pain but precipitates death. You know that there are do not resuscitate orders on beds in hospitals. That's not trying to preserve life. That's trying to give someone a dignified death. It happens every day.
Yes, Stephen, but fortunately we do have, or unfortunately we do have, the examples of Oregon, Canada and Holland. And once you change the law for these very, very difficult circumstances, you open the floodgates to the situation now in some countries where you can have your life ended, not because you're physically ill, but because you're mentally ill. Now, and the numbers rise exponentially over the years, because once you accept that it's right to end someone's life, then the criteria to enable that to happen become less and less stringent. Now, what I think a Member of Parliament, the lady in Westminster, should be doing is introducing a private member's bill to make palliative care mandatory for all who request it. That's our problem.
The person talking with you today is the Reverend Rosie Harper, a Church of England priest and a member of the campaign group Dignity in Dying. Reverend Harper, why don't you engage directly with Jim this morning?
Yeah, well, I think it's very interesting that you're quoting different countries with different laws. The country that I'm familiar with, because I'm half Swiss, is Switzerland, where in fact they have chosen in some ways to tighten up the laws so that it's even more more properly, sensibly controlled. So you don't inevitably have to go down that route. Each country will get the law that they choose to have. And in Switzerland, the numbers haven't gone up. And it's very interesting. Obviously, I'm of an age where I know lots of people, my relatives, who are dying or have died recently. And they have a completely different experience of growing old and approaching the end of their life, not because they will accept assisted dying, but because they know it's a possibility. So you take one huge dynamic of fear of dying out of your social handling of death, and the whole thing becomes something other than what we experience in this country, where people commit suicide in the most awful ways because there are no other options, where people have to travel abroad and have assisted dying long before they really need to, if they can afford it. What we've got now is chaotic and cruel. And this is not that loads of people would do assisted dying, but it's just that if it's one of the many ways in which you can die, that will be a kind and generous and compassionate option for some people.
Jim?
Well, Stephen, I know you don't like me raising this issue, but when abortion was first brought in GB in 1967, it was for these very, very specific and difficult cases, and it required two doctors to sign it off. Now we've had 10 million abortions in the UK, and now it's abortion on demand, and there's no barrier whatsoever to a mother being asked for the pregnancy to be terminated. And the reality is, once you open the floodgates, it's almost impossible to stop the demands for further relaxation. And the evidence from Holland and from Canada has shown that very, very clearly. And now we've even got to the stage where some people are opting for assisted suicide for mental health. And indeed, in one case in Oregon, or sorry, in Canada, the person was destitute. He had nowhere to live. And the suggestion was to him, though you're mentally and physically fine, have you thought of assisted suicide? Now, that's the danger. Now, if we were to introduce a proper program of palliative care for everyone in this situation, I think the demand for assisted dying would reduce dramatically. And that's the major problem we have. We don't have enough hospices. We don't have enough care for the terminally ill in Northern Ireland. And I have seen the work of the hospices, and I can tell you it's excellent and offers real hope of a peaceful death to many, many people.
Well, thanks for that. And I do actually really agree with you about palliative care. The interesting thing is that statistics in Oregon, where things actually are not as you describe in other countries, is that the quality of palliative care has gone up, as improved, alongside offering assisted dying as one of the options. So it's not an either-or thing. I firmly believe we should have better palliative care in the UK as well as in Ireland. But I think that they're not polar opposites. They should work alongside each other as a menu of different ways in which you can live out your final days.
David's in East Belfast. Good morning, David.
To answer your question, how can death be beautiful? Well, if you accept that life is beautiful, then a peaceful death is part of the process, and therefore, by extension, should be beautiful. But anyway, my main point is that the Justin Welby, or the slippery slope argument, doesn't really hold much water. Because in that case, any new and important invention or improvement would be part of a slippery slope. That's a very negative way of looking at things. It is actually a developmental process. It's why we are what we are. It's why the world is the way that it is.
What do you mean? I have no idea what you're talking about. Tell me what you mean.
Well, what I'm saying is that it was said that Justin Welby, or said a slippery slope, you introduce assisted suicide, assisted dying, and that is part of a slippery slope. Well, if you say that that is a slippery slope, then the development of nuclear power, the development of the internet, the development of any important legal or technological development is part of a slippery slope, which is no good way of looking at development.
Do you support?
I do.
Why?
What?
Why?
Because I think it's a question, whose life is it anyhow? If it's in my life and I find that I am in a situation where I am terminally ill, in dreadful pain, then I should have I should be able to decide, provided I'm compos mentis, that I wish to terminate my life at any particular point in my process. Because death is part of the process of life.
Mm-hmm.
So is there, David, if we take that position that you've got,
yes,
and let's just look at different scenarios. Is it possible that society, if assisted dying were to be legal in Northern Ireland, is it possible that society would deem it slightly more acceptable if you were older than younger? Or would you be as comfortable if a 10-year-old with a terminal illness decided to take their own life as you would with an 80-year-old?
Well, yes, I see what you mean, but if it is a terminal illness, the problem with young people or younger people is that they have so much of their life ahead of them.
But a 10-year-old with a terminal illness doesn't necessarily. So would you be as comfortable?
Well, would a 10-year-old be able to decide for themselves?
But you're making my point for me.
Yeah.
Tell a 10-year-old that's going to go through, that's been through lots of operations, that has so much more experience than the majority of us, because
yeah,
we haven't been in hospital,
yeah,
that they don't have the capacity and they're in pain.
Or
increase it to a 12-year-old,
yeah,
increase it to a 15-year-old.
Yeah.
Like, it's complicated,
yeah,
is it not?
Oh, yes, it's complicated. But so is any important new development complicated. And actually, when it comes to the bed, one of the biggest complications is people's attitude to it.
So, David, to answer the question then, do you think a 10-year-old might have the capacity to take their own life?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, they might. But I don't know. I mean, I suspect. I mean, I know that young people of that age and young people and teenagers, they look at their lives completely differently. And they, in fact, they're much braver than somebody like me who's away in their late 70s would be.
Jim, is this the slippery slope you're talking about?
I'm afraid it is, Stephen. I'm sitting outside a nursing home here at the moment, and twice in my life I have been asked, would I sign a do not resuscitate form for a very, very close relative?
Your wife?
Yes. The doctors on both occasions said it's highly unlikely that my wife would survive. She was out of the country in Western concert with me last night, having a wonderful time in Ballinahinch. And that's where you can get it terribly wrong. And that's why I think we cannot go down this route. We cannot open the floodgates. But what we can do is use this very important argument to increase the care that we give for people who are terminally ill. That's what we need to be focusing on. And I think if people have got a choice between assisted dying and an excellent palliative care regime, I know what the vast majority of people would choose.
But Jim, would you not be torn if your wife, who you've known all your life, said to you, I want to go now? Would you not be torn in the vulnerable state she's in, acting against her wishes?
Well, I think given my wife's background, that's highly unlikely she would pose that question. But secondly, I would then be immediately looking, for instance, to places like the Southern Area Hospice in Newry, which does fantastic work. And you find that if people are fortunate enough to get admission to a hospice, then all thoughts of assisted dying disappear because the care is such a high standard.
Big Barbara's called us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. I'm on about this too. I think I would agree for to be able to take my own life after what I'm going through. I mean, I'm 82 now, and the way I look at it, I've had my day. But I still prattle on to try and keep going, and it hurts me every day with things I have wrong with me.
But why is age?
I mean, the hospital, I've been in four hospitals there in 2 months. Four hospitals in 2 months. 2 years ago, with the same complaint, my doctor told me 2 years ago that if I had a major operation, I'd die. And they asked me for doing an operation there on the 15th of August, and I refused the operation because it told me I was going to die on the table. So I refused the operation. So I just keep on to whatever is going to kill me. And if I say someday, if I want to take my own life, I'd do it.
But Barbara, you say you're 82 and that's part of the reason why you do it. You see, what's age got to do with it? Your life is as valuable at 82 as it is when you were 18, is it not?
No, but you don't know what you're going through, Stephen. I know what I'm going through this last 5 years, and more so lately. More so lately. I've got tumours that has been taken away from my body. I've had half a bowel taken away. I've had keyhole surgery. And now I've got another tumour growing on my right-hand side, a cyst growing on my left-hand side, and they wanted me to have that operation, but they told me I wouldn't come off the table.
So
I didn't have the operation. They try and keep going. Could I live to Christmas? I'll be happy enough.
So given your... Well, let's hope you live longer than that, Barbara. You've been...
Well, I don't know, Stephen, how long this tumour's going to kill me.
So if it were legal in Northern Ireland, would you like to time your own death?
Yes, I would, because I know the pain I'm going through this last 5 years and all, Stephen, and the operations I've had and everything. And then I have a bad heart too, like, so they told me my heart never
but
skipped the operation.
But how can you time your own death? How can you choose the right time, Barbara? You're well enough at the moment to pick up the phone. I know you're in pain. I know it's hard to get about. But you're having a conversation with me. You're living life. How would you time when you would take your own life?
Well, have I really come to the stage, Stephen, that I could not get about, right? If I had to sit in the house all day and not get about, I think I would think more about it.
But is it not society then? Is
and
that
I've
not
already talked it out with my family.
But is that not an easy out for society? Because surely what society should be doing is making sure that you can continue to go out.
But then if my house gets shot bad and I'm going to be housebound, what's chancellor than living?
Norman and Bangor. Morning, Norman. Maybe you could speak to Barbara this morning. Stay there, Barbara. Go ahead, Norman.
Right. Morning, Stephen. I don't agree with Barbara. God brings you into this world and God will take you out of this world when he sees fit. I watched my daughter die at 34 years of age with cancer, suffering, and not once did she ask me or her mother to take her own life.
And do you think, Norman, and I don't want to be crass about this, so it's a genuine question.
Yeah.
Do you think God wanted your daughter to suffer at the end of her life? Was that God's will? And why would any God want that to happen?
Stephen, God suffered on the cross and man brought sin into the world and he brought death into the world. And that's why people suffer today, because of man bringing sin and death into the world. So there's hospices. I've lost friends out of the church who had cancer. They went into their hospice. They had a peaceful death. So they had when God called them home. And we go down this road. It was like abortion. It came in. Only if the mother's life is in danger would somebody have an abortion. Now it's abortion on demand. And if they bring euthanasia in, people who are in nursing homes with dementia, who are a burden on the state or a burden on their family, just give them a jag and get rid of them. That's the road we are going down.
Reverend Rosie Harper, you are a minister. You're listening to this. Norman making religious arguments why this can't happen. You're a minister.
Yes.
You think it can?
Yes. I think it's a profoundly different way of understanding what sort of a God you believe in. I have.
There's only one God you believe in. He brought us into this world and he'd take us out of this world and he died on the cross for our sins. I don't know what God you believe in.
Well, I believe in a God who has given me my life, and I believe that with the most enormous gratitude, but I do believe that my life is an actual gift. It's not terms and conditions.
It is a gift, but it's not a gift for you to take your own life. God will take you out of this world when the time comes.
Let's let her finish, Norman.
No. I think it's very hard for me to believe that I'm in bed suffering because, admittedly, hospices are fantastic, but there are people for whom they cannot control the pain. And I do not believe in a God who stands at the end of my bed and says, no, Rosie, I know you want this to end, but you've got to suffer for another 3 weeks yet before it's my time for you to die. What I believe in is a loving God to whom I can say, I've loved my life, I'm hugely grateful, and now I want to return that gift to you.
There is an action line, bbc.co.uk/action line, if you need any help as a result of listening to this today. Frank's in Belfast. Morning, Frank.
Morning. I never want to die. I've been at the store many times. And my life, I was born with a hard cleft palate. When I was 8, I had TB, and my mother got a telegram wanting me up there because I was dying, you know. And I went through all sorts of pains and kidney problems, and I went out into the world, and I went to live abroad, and I went out for adventure, and I went out to enjoy what was going to come. And if it wasn't going to come, I'd still persevere with wanting. And that's what you need to have. You want life, you got to try and hope. And pray,
but Frank,
if you want to pray.
But Frank, this is potentially annoying, stroke offensive to those people who want life as much as you do, but they've been told they've got a terminal illness, and no matter what they want, it's not going to happen. They're going to die, and they're going to die in pain. That's how they believe their life ahead of them to be.
Yes. Well, I wasn't told that I was going to die. But if I was told that I was going to die, I would still want the best of their life before it.
Yes, of course you would. But for those people that are bedridden, linked up the machines.
Well, I have been linked up the bed. I've been on drips and all that business, but I know it's not going to be forever. But I would still want to live, and I don't know why. I think I would want to live.
Okay.
Because I'm still alive.
Well, look, this private members bill is being introduced into the House of Commons today. It'll apply to people in England and Wales, not here in Northern Ireland, but no doubt it'll be prompted in the debate here. We're on Nolan Live tonight, 10:40, BBC One. It'll be politics all the way tonight, the telly. We'll see you then. Have a good day in between, and thanks for listening.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.